Would anyone like to say or ask anything?
I have a question in relation to what we discussed the other day here and, about our programming and spontaneous action. So it seems on one level in the practice there is encouragement to kind of break the rules, notice the programming and try to break the habit and do the opposite. And there's another level of kind of tune into the being and just being the big mind, you can say. And in that state, first it seems like there's, it doesn't really matter if there is programming or not. But also, is it true that while tuning to this this being, naturally those programming kind of dissolve because there is nothing to feed them, nothing to fuel them? And if this is the case, so why is it not enough?
So what have you noticed when you tune to being, and then what happens with the programming for you so far?
I see a lot of patterns just with time, kind of not make any sense, and so a lot of this stuff just, when I look back, they're not really there. Not like by trying to do something. Mm. But also, when I ask this question, I see that sometimes working actively with those habits, sometimes it's really fun and kind of play, but other times can be very difficult or scary. And there's kind of tendency to go the other way, where it's seems more easy. But I wonder if there is this easy way.
So I want to mention first also kind of a third way, and then maybe they're not so different, all the three ways. So a third way is feeling, excuse me, feeling the programming, reactivity, compulsion, whatever, and just being with that. Being with that without the no to it, without the resistance to it, or with less resistance to it, or aware of the resistance as part of the package, just being with that package.
Is it not the same as the being? For me, it's kind of...
It's quite, yeah. And so, but I could be tuning to the being, and from the being feeling the package of programming, including my hatred of the programming, mm-hmm. love, hate. And that, but there could be where I'm really just accepting, there's not any sort of, not this, but this, I have to go somewhere to be able to be with that programming instead of being taken away by it. So we can call it being, backing up, giving space, feeling it. But it's a little bit different to kind of tune to being, like finding a deeper layer of okayness and letting that become primary if possible. Or with okayness as a kind of, it's not a ground, it's not a hardness, but it gives support to feel the habit energy. And from there, it could be that thing of actively breaking the rules playfully happens. It could be, or it could be that naturally we just do kind of fade that one out and fade the okayness in. or anything could happen. So that we're really free no matter what, no matter where we land, we can feel what's real. And being in touch with what's real, whatever, in whatever angle, is a way, can be a way. And so, like you mentioned, playful, I think that can be good. Sometimes it's hard, and that could be good. It's like that first night, the metaphor of the medicinal pea. It looks terrible, smells terrible, tastes terrible, and it's really, really helpful sometimes. I think that one of the things you're kind of... talking about is, and you mentioned when tuning to the being, as your in your words, then the programming actually is not so important. And that's really helpful to realize. And in the Buddhist teachings also, they're not saying that then at some point there's zero programming. They're saying that there is form, there is vedana, the filtering, there is perception, there is sanskar. So there is shape, there is impression in the psyche, and there is consciousness. But there's not sticking to. There's not taking it as mine. And so that what's interesting is getting that fluidity, flexibility of programming, haha. And also programming, ouch. And just the fact it hurts. And the fact that it hurts is also coming back into that. We can playfully call it instinctual, like spiritual, instinctual. It hurts because it doesn't fit. It's not true. And if that hurts, so then the amoeba goes somewhere else as a resting place. And then it's a shift not from one sticking place to another sticking place. Also, so it's not so much about fiddling around with the programming, that it does happen and it does help to find more fluidity and less stickiness when the programming is more light and when we notice that it can't be me, it can't be mine. But then it can be a fearful moment when we realize we actually don't want to go from one sticking place to another sticking place. However good the new sticking place, we actually don't want to stick. We're not made for sticking. And so kind of getting the hang of that there can be a kind of support that isn't a hardness, isn't something we can count on in the old way. That we can push against. And so in the lovely, awesome talk that Tracy gave yesterday, that exploration of letting us find where the feet are at home in the ground, and the ground is welcoming the feet. And that can sound like a contradiction, where the feet are looking for the ground to feel solid. But when we're trying to find ground, there's not rest. And when we kind of give up, and so last week we talked about that opening, receiving, rather than going out to get. And the opening, receiving into whatever it is, it is something. Papaji used to give the metaphor of baby animals being traveling with their moms. And he said, if you want, you can be like the baby monkey holding onto the mother, you know, everywhere, like, what a ride, you know, okay, that could be fun. But as a metaphor for our practice, do we want to be holding on the whole time? It's all my work. Or the metaphor of the mother cat and the baby cat. The mother cat picks up the baby and carries the baby over to safety or food or rest or whatever. And if you've seen the baby cat being carried, I don't know if there's some pressure points or something maybe, or if it's just makes sense to be really, really relaxed when you got those teeth on your neck. But it's a good metaphor, including the teeth of the mother, because the transition to the kind of, again, belief, assumption, compulsion, whatever word, maybe for now compulsion, like that force that we're like, there's the breath, I've got the breath, okay, it's going down, it's coming up, I've got it, you know, and then we realize what we've got is my own effort. And where's the breath again? Okay, erase that, come back, there is a breath, oh, there's a breath, okay. But the transition from our habit energy of grabbing, sticking to, trying to get some kind of hard ground, some hard confirmation, pressure as a feeling of, that it's okay, support, to another kind of support. So, that, have you seen the baby cats being carried? Can you remember the total limp? But it is scary. I think it's naturally a scary transition. I think it naturally would bring for us, if we, I all my life was a monkey, and now the cat has me by the neck. Of course, I'm freaking out. Almas talks about false will and true will. I don't so much like, I don't love his language. I find it's a little bit absolute, but our normal understanding of will, willpower, or just will, and another way of being moved. And he's noticed that what we understand as will is a hardness in the body, a contraction, especially around the heart area. And so basically from that experience, tuning into the feeling of not enough, so not trusting, and then, okay, I've got to do something. So then the trying to find my will so that I can do what needs to be done. And we're so well-intentioned in doing that. It's in a way, it's worth grieving over that so many well-intentioned people trying to get what we feel our heart wants. We hear some kind of echoing of like the heart wants freedom or wants kindness or to be kind or something. And then to get there, our understanding is that we've got to have a stepping, he says, like a stepping stone. So there's a hardness that actually closes the heart. And then from there, we feel we can act. And to first notice that it automatically can't work because we've closed access to what was going to direct us. He seems to find that the belief in not enough is more around the solar plexus, and then that wanting to have a stepping stone leverage point where I can push off from to do something is then around the heart, a kind of closing, a physical contraction. It's okay? And that at first, when we notice that doesn't work, letting go of the physical contraction, so letting go of what he calls the false will, the monkey holding on for dear life to the mom. Before we've had a chance to practice enough to feel something else that could lift us up, feels like an emptiness that we're just going to fall and not stop falling. And so then usually we go back to contraction will. But sometimes either the circumstances force us because we can't anymore, or there's some interest or a trickle of trust that we stay with that empty feeling and differentiate it from the not enough belief. Just feels like an empty hole. And then that's that riverbed that Tracy G spoke of yesterday and that we've been talking about, receptivity. Almas says that actually there's even traditionally the symbol of the crescent moon. So the actual, that receptive curve shape, which we had such a lovely one last night. I almost fell over when I saw it. The crescent moon, then the star is our real intelligence. So receptive to a real intelligence. So it's like we do kind of fall. We fall out of monkey mode into cat mode, kitten mode. And there isn't something back there. There's not a hard thing that we land on. Which is a cool way of exploring contact with the earth. Like, of course there is hardness, but I find the more I get into even not the earth, but this ground that's above the earth, I think it's worth playing with from time to time. I think it's not just a sensation of hardness, but and in the cat, kitten mode receptivity, in a way, we find there is not that support that we thought we needed. And it's such a relief that we don't actually need that hardness to support us. Sometimes playing with, like we did this morning in the movement, or maybe, I can't remember if I did in the meditation also, but feeling the back of the body and playing with even slightly moving backwards with the back of the body or resting into the back of the body can have a subtle physical sensation that feels like as if we can really be in the back and it can be full and quiet and awake and alive. And as if that there's no hardness supporting, but there's the softness of nothingness supporting, something like that. And as embryos, the cells that then became our back, the back of the baby that we all were, are more connected to the holding environment of the in the womb, that floating, enclosed but space. Not a hardness, but definitely support. I came across yet another just shockingly honest statement in the book of Jacques Lucieron. And it's about that time when he and his friends are starting to form their group within the many other groups of the resistance. And sometimes it's not an exaggeration to accept the Nazi rule and occupation of France as a metaphor for our state in our psyche. Sometimes it's really not an exaggeration. We would rather die than live like that. And what's going to help us not give up? What's going to help get some space in that assumption that it's going to always be like that? So heavy-handed. And so at a certain point, I think it was in 1943, it still looked like Hitler was going to, his people were going to actually take everything. They were doing well in Russia. And one of Jacques' friends, the response is really breathtaking. So the news is the worst possible news. And the friend of Jacques, who was working with him in the resistance, 16-year-old, said, I'll read it so I don't mess it up. Said, just think, what a celebration if after all this, there's not a chance. What a celebration. If after all this, so they've been risking their lives. Some people have been creating a newspaper with real news, and they would get bundles of 1,000 and they would spread them out, which is obviously risking your life. So feeling for the underground news under that control freak, the negativity that dominates, etc. What's the real news? So what if all that they did wasn't going to achieve anything? What a celebration, he's saying. Just think, what a celebration if after all this, there's not a chance. They're just ghosts, the ones who think people fight to win. They fight because they like it.
Can you read it again?
Yeah. The whole thing or from the middle? They are just ghosts, the ones who think people fight to win. They fight because they like it. Does it make sense? No? No. It's a little bit like what Asafji was saying, that the he notices programming, he tunes into being, and then the programming, it's another perspective. But it's that they're not doing what needs to be done out of fear and out of an agenda. It's a spontaneously arising thing that needs to be done, that's being done, and that's all. It's complete. And in doing what needs to be done, even at the risk of death or worse, there's a liking. And so there's a poem that actually I had brought a couple days ago and so relevant to your investigation of impulse and inspiration. It's by Carl Sandburg. Somewhere in here. You were made for joy, child. The feet of you were carved for that. Yeah? The ankles of you run for that. So I want to pause here. I'll read more, hopefully, but... You were made for joy, child. This woman, Dhammadinna, who left her married life to find a way to awakening, and then did so. Talks about programming. So programming usually is tied to the pleasant and unpleasant. It's tied to that survival tendency of first things first, let's survive, therefore whatever's pleasant is going to be what's helpful, what's unpleasant is. So my system takes as painful what would be a threat and takes as pleasant what my programming understands is ally. Everything else unimportant. So we can see, I mean, we can notice ourselves like the dogs of Pavlov, really conditioned. There's that stimulus and that reaction. Repeated a few times, that's what happens. And I just want to, I'm just going to interject another scientific experiment with mice. Mice or rats, I'm not sure which rodent, but. In trying to understand heroin addiction, scientists working with mice and heroin. And so the first experiment they did, there was just the mouse in the cage with the heroin, and they could just go and take, drink it whenever they wanted to. And so they did. And luckily, the scientists realized that this was a little bit of a setup. If there's nothing else going on, then probably the animal is going to go check out what is the one thing that's happening in this life. So then they set up a different environment that was more like a natural mouse life with lots of mice and lots of things going on and food and water and heroin. And the mice didn't care about the heroin. There was no interest in heroin. So feeling for what conditions, because the path to the unconditioned is conditioned, feeling for what conditions make us less likely to go into our addiction, into our programming. What situations make us more likely to have no other choice? Dhammadinna talking about pain and pleasure. So in a scientific experiment, using pain and pleasure to try to see what happens. How does this make an animal behave when there's pain and pleasure? And she says that underlying the experience of pleasure basically is programming. Underlying the experience of pain is programming, which is then resting on top of, we can call the belief, or let's say maybe the experiential belief of not enoughness, or that hole, that emptiness uninvestigated, unentered. So fear of that emptiness, taking that as meaning not enough, and going from there underlies almost all of our experience of pain, pleasure, and neither. And then her ex-husband Visakha asks if that's the case for every single pleasure, every single pain, every single neutral experience. And she says no. And this is where I come to, we're made for joy. So in a human being, there is a joy and pleasure that is not a programming. And that joy and pleasure is coming into meditation, is making the transition from monkey to kitten. Trusting that without that hardness of support, without that contraction that I understood as willpower, some other way, just by being the kitten and pausing And that pleasure that comes as we stop being so interested in fixing my programming or being in my programming or my programming as my programming at all. There starts to be more space that in this other kind of pleasure can happen. And there might be a greed, the monkey wanting to have that pleasure. But just by being in that pleasure that isn't programmed, it heals the underlying belief in not enough. The painful situation that she says, this is what her experience was, and her teacher Gautam agreed with her. At the end, finally, she says, okay, if you don't believe me, go ask Gautam and just remember whatever he says. Forget what I've said, remember what he says. And of course, Gautam says, I would have said exactly what she said. Remember it exactly as she said it. So what's the painful sensation that's not painful because of my programming? It's painful in an alive way, in a way that maybe leads somewhere. Does that make sense?
Mm.
And what she says is there's a grief. When we know, we have the thought, when am I going to be living on that base? I would call it that. Groundless support. But when am I going to reach that base where the awakened ones live? And feeling grief. So the yearning that Tracy G spoke about yesterday of the riverbed. The yearning of the riverbed. And here again, it can certainly happen that the thought, when will I be enlightened like them? When will I be awakened like them? Can trigger programming of not enough, based on not enough. But if we can not just throw the whole thing away, I think it's a place that we're in touch with what's real and possible. It's kind of a knowing that I'm made for awakening. This is made to awaken.
Can you maybe explain or talk a little bit more about what exactly is being grieved?
What exactly is being grieved?
Yeah, like if there's a grieving to say, you know, when will I be on this plane of the awakened ones? Is the grieving of the self that is being left? Or is the grieving of the desire that you don't have yet? What's being...
I think that it can be so mixed, and including mixed with our low self-esteem, etc. But I think there is a very kind of true movement of longing, which I experience as... It includes a kind of knowing of what the calling is, what the pull is. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when there's a story of two lovers as a metaphor for the path, I think it's Majnu who and Layla, no? He's so in love with Layla, but he can't have her. Because they're probably from different families, religions, classes, whatever. That story. And he can't think of anything else, and he sings to her. He writes poetry to her. He tries to get messages to her. And finally, one day, there's a message that she's coming, and so meet me in that pagoda out in the desert under the third palm tree or whatever. and maybe his friends get him there because he's so in love with Lila that he's now dressed up as Lila. And he's there in the pagoda in the desert by the third palm tree. And Lila comes and says, Majnu, I'm here. And he's confused because he's Lila. So in really Buddhist language, Dhammadinna is saying that there is pleasure and happiness that comes not by programming, that's worth enjoying. And it'll kind of take care of anywhere that we might start trying to identify with it, because it'll go away as soon as we identify with it. And that yearning, the call, the pull, is worth feeling. And gradually refining that we're letting go of where it's purely just, I'll never get there or something like that, but just, there's a confidence in the yearning. There's some kind of knowing. It's not like, oh, I'll never get there. It's clearly I'm not there and can be. And that yearning of I don't know how, the helplessness. So it's a kind of surrendering. It's a kind of surrendering into the actual situation. And then from the actual situation, it emerges the spontaneous next step, which is what Almas calls true will. He says it's not that there's false will and then nothing else. It's false will and true will, in his words. But I just call that emergence, or spontaneity in Kailash's words from the other day. Yes, Shai, Ji.
Sorry, I just didn't get the story.
Oh, of Lila and Mushu. Okay.
I lost something there. When he...
So Mushu's in love with Lila,
yes. And
he can't have her. So he's just stuck with his love, which seems to be about Lila, but he doesn't have her. So he's got his love of Lila, and it's really intense. And gradually, he doesn't actually need Lila anymore. So when Lila comes, he doesn't recognize her because he has become Lila. He's gone so into the love of her, what he thought she was or whatever. He's let the love have him, and the love has made him Lila. So then there's no gap between him and what he loves. He's just, the love turned him into that. Yeah?
Good.
Okay.
Jai, you know what's really cool is Lila is night.
Oh, cool.
So the dark. Kind of.
Could you hear that?
No.
You can say it.
She's saying that Lila means dark.
Night.
So it could be where we start to love that emptiness, where there's not the hardened heart. And something's going to emerge. Start trusting nowhere that something's going to come out of it, something good.
Maya.
That's again the dark, the nothingness. It's also Maya.
Yeah. But then the not being afraid of dark and Maya, letting it move the heart, and then not by a hardening of will, how I'm going to do this, but what happens? Being in touch with what's real, what happens spontaneously.
Jai, I'm not sure if this is quite on track, but is there the possibility in this leaning back and allowing for the spontaneity to emerge that you're just trying to form another pattern?
Of course. You could.
So how do you know the difference?
When there is stress, there's pattern. When there's conflict, there's pattern.
So
when there's fear. When there's the dissatisfaction that moves you, it's programming going on.
Though it may appear.
It could, but for a while it might appear, oh, this is so good, because now I have permission to turn the critic off, and I think I'm doing it right.
Mm.
For a little while, it can last. It doesn't last very long. We have relief from thinking I don't have, trying to get what I don't have, trying to be who I'm not. And it's like, oh, cool, I got it. It's a little bit like placebo effect, kind of. Yeah. And so, but what actually usually happens is a bit like layers. We're a bit more in the flow, and then that's so good and natural, and it is more powerful, more easeful, more wide, and more fine, precise. And then we start to feel like, oh, there's something unsustainable happening, and we find that place of pressure, contraction, not enough, and let that fall apart, etc.
Towards all the other bits, that some of them might also be good, like besides meditation.
Yeah, good. That's a good question. Good question. I agree with your disliking. So what's happening is the untrue relationship to what is, that this is good because I like it, and this is bad because I don't like it. It's just my programming. It's not what is. I'm actually not in touch with what is. I'm in touch with my programming. And I experience that as me. And so when it's not that the things are bad because I don't go buy into my programming. So I liked this and I didn't like that because of my programming, my past experience. When I'm less interested in the programming, I'm much more available for the goodness all around, including what I didn't like before. And so what she says about the neither pleasant nor unpleasant, so the neutral, is that when we're not aware of it, it's unpleasant. When we are in touch with it, it is pleasant. So it's like this whole huge field of much more pleasant living. Doesn't mean exciting, just a whole bunch of burdensome moments are a bit more enlivening. We can really appreciate things that we otherwise couldn't notice before. We couldn't notice it. It was outside of our binoculars. And now noticing it, and there's appreciation, more appreciation. So it's getting more free to enjoy more, not only what I thought I liked. And then we see how what I was compelled to approach or try to get, how uncomfortable that relationship is. And unfree. So Almas gives the example of, I was just looking for. He gives an example of instead of trying to get satisfaction, we allow ourselves to have basic trust, which just means that instead of pretending, let me just be in touch and something's going to happen. This is a true life. Instead of trying to get satisfaction, fulfillment, happiness, love, we allow ourselves to have basic trust. Then all that we do, our relationships, and all our activities are an expression of the satisfaction, fulfillment, and love. The true life is a spontaneous activity that arises out of our essence, and there's no need for the efforting kind of will. You've got everything. You simply need to see the truth, and which just means be in touch. See the truth. And he gives an example of a woman with the boyfriend, and she's dissatisfied, and she thinks it's because the boyfriend isn't giving her enough sex. That's his example that she follows through. And then getting down to the bottom of it, realizing that then that means her connection with the boyfriend is, as he calls it, a live dildo. If she's unsatisfied because he's not giving her orgasms often enough. And so then that's not really a relationship with a human being. She's dissatisfied, and so she wants him to give her more.
Yeah, but what came before that? What's he explaining?
He's talking about the difference between the monkey and the cat, basically. Yeah. In the relationship, she's feeling unsatisfied.
Yeah.
So she thinks, then maybe I'll get satisfied if he gives me more sex.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah. Just whatever. The kitchen to give me more rice or whatever. Yeah, could be anything.
She decides that.
Somehow she starts to think, or she's compelled to think, that it must be that he's got to give me more orgasm. Then I'll be okay. And what he's saying is you don't need to do anything about it. The functioning of true will causes you to do what is needed. And I do, there's one word that I do like that I also like to use, is considering this as an organism and trusting the organism to know what to do, given the space to do it, to be in touch with what is and then to do. Most of our discontent, pain, and discomfort is the result of losing a part of ourselves. It's not because of the economy. It's not because we are ugly or fat or this or that. These are not the real reasons. So trying to get fulfillment by solving these supposed problems doesn't work. So that's this idea that it's not so much about getting rid of my programming and then I'll be okay also. It's just noticing what's the situation. There is programming, and that's not all. Giving a little space to that's not all. Something else happens that's not programming. And that is satisfying, even if we don't get what we want. Does that fit your experience, Karen G? Or say more? Okay, so say more.
It's better, but still there are things that I like, and there is great joy in them. So it's not only in like, okay, I begin to get joy from the things that I didn't like, but also in so many things. And even this example about the girl and the boyfriend, so it didn't feel so very wrong to me.
Well, but you know the dynamic? That I start to decide that my existential dissatisfaction is your fault.
Yes, of course.
I'm going to get way less sex.
Yes, it's obviously like, okay, give me more sex is not the right thing, but it's also that if you're in a relationship and you feel like you're not getting enough sex, then maybe something is not right, and maybe something should change.
And so what he's saying, which you don't have to agree with, what he's saying is definitely. And where is that movement going to happen from? Is it going to happen from there's a problem, we've got to fix it? Or is it going to happen from what's happening, let me listen to you, let you listen to me, what's actually happening? And then unexpectedly, whoa, oh, cool.
It's also in kind of sense, this also begins by being able to say, hey, listen, I feel that I'm not getting enough sex, so whatever, you know, I'm not getting
enough sex. As a rule? You have to say that as a rule? Or
Nothing is a rule, but it's often very helpful, yes. So I found it to be.
So I think he's just saying, be aware of if we think there's this one rule that's going to save us from our dissatisfaction, mm-hmm. I think. And the relaxing into and then letting something speak or be fierce or be kind or be slow or be whatever is in my experience, not so much from the basis of the problem. It's from the basis of the potential. And I think that makes communication much easier. And then with when there's communication, like so much can happen. So, of course, having full confidence and trust in life and knowing that things happen spontaneously does not mean that you don't act in your life. I don't mean that there is no activity, no action, no preferences in your life. When true will is functioning or when kitten mode is on, activities and preferences come from a real place. They are spontaneous expressions of who you are, not reactions to something you don't like. Expressions of the truth of the situation rather than attempts to change that truth. Letting go of the false will might be scary. You might feel as if you're falling into emptiness. You might wonder whether you will be able to function without it. But when real will is present, there is no feeling of fear, no feeling that the emptiness is bad and that you will fall into it. If there is no true will and no false will, the experience is fear. Fear of falling, of no support, of no recourse. But when there is emptiness, which is the lack of a contraction and the presence of true will, you experience openness rather than fear. How we'd be a kitten.
In a situation.
Yes. Every situation. I want to just mention this subject gave me another insight into that same story of Gotam, his turning point on his path. So I'm just going to use that as the first one, but then we can find more. And we just had the example of the relationship issue and where I'm the monkey. I'm so unlikely to get what I want, and if I get it, it won't be satisfying. Partly because I know I've made it, I've forced it, wasn't given, and partly because I'm not in my place where I could receive and feel satisfaction. Neither from my own side nor from what's coming from outside will there be satisfaction. Whereas from another way, even if I don't get what I want, there could be a feeling of meeting, at least with myself. So an already okayness, and then if we have sex, great. So it just struck me, this shift from the hardened will and then what I would just call the openness, receptivity, and letting something bubble up, well up, that Almas is calling true will or spontaneity. And it just struck me, first of all, that as we're starting to get into meditation, sometimes there can be strange things that happen. The body can shake or feel hot and cold. There could be even just a feeling of intense energy in the body, sometimes pleasurable, but almost so intense that it's not pleasurable anymore. And I think that many times the intensity of that comes because of that hardened will. So what I've noticed is much more often, I'm not saying it's across the board, but much more often, there are these more noticeable signs of release when there's been a strong compulsion of that old kind of will. Really trusting my own trying. And that by letting the pressure off, sometimes that release of the way that we're wound up, the release can happen with less intensity. It can be easier on the system. But then the transition, just a sec, then the transition from hardening myself to push off and get something done that I think I should get done, like enlightenment or orgasm. Even though there's a feeling that this is the way to go, there's joy and the longing is pulling in that direction as well. The joy is opening out that way and the longing is pulling that way. The pull is pulling that way. I think it's really significant that Gotam has this line in his story there that he felt afraid. I just realized it's not, I think he's talking about that big fear. The fear that we're going to die, that happens when we really start to go in and find that there's not that kind of support I thought there had to be. It isn't there. So we find it wasn't supportive, and if I let go of that that wasn't supportive, there's nothing. And it can be a panic. We can be afraid we're going crazy. The whole body is jolted into fear of survival fear. And that is part of the process, that gradually we notice we didn't die. And it's part of growing the voltage capacity also.
At what point in the story did he...
So he's said all of that trying so hard didn't help.
Yeah.
I didn't gain any superhuman powers. Maybe there's another way. Then the memory of the child experience where... resting under the tree, happy and joy, happy in the body, happy in the mind, feeling quite complete, contained. And the happiness comes from feeling complete and contained rather than feeling incomplete. That is called happiness born of seclusion. And what they mean by seclusion is not getting away from everything, but feeling complete rather than incomplete. So trusting that maybe it is okay, maybe this is complete, rather than, oh my God, I'm not quite enough. So trusting enoughness comes a happiness in the body and the mind. And then he said he felt fear of that pleasure, because it's this word that can be translated as happy or pleasure. And it is actually, the experience is both. And I think it's not just in the suttas, sometimes they have all this extra words, but sometimes there's just that one line and it's really there for a reason. It's pointing out something important. And today I just realized that it's more important. What he's talking about is more important than what I thought before.
He had fear as a child?
Sorry?
He had the fear as a child?
No, he didn't. So it's not really fear of the state itself. It's fear of where that's going, which is away from the hardened will. Which seems like a letting go of control, seems like a letting go of power, seems like a falling into an empty hole with no bottom.
So he didn't understand. When he said that he felt the fear.
So he remembered that time as a child. Mm-hmm. So he's given up on trying too hard. He's given up on false will. But luckily he didn't give up completely. Maybe there's another way. Then the memory comes of when he was a child. And then he thinks maybe that's the way. And I'm saying that it's not about that first jhana state. It's about how naturally that can come. Because he'd already practiced the jhanas better than his teachers. They wanted him to take over their monastery. It comes naturally, and it's a natural movement away from being in control, we could say, thinking they were in control. And that's what he was, that's when the fear came. If, oh, that's the way, oh, maybe that's the way. He thought, maybe that's the way. Letting go of trying to make it happen. Letting go of mommy, actually, out there. And then letting mommy have you by the neck. And then, even though, he repeats, even though I felt fear, this is the way, and I'll go.
So he was feeling fear of losing control because it was something that...
He's fear of, like all of us, letting go of something that feels hard, that makes me think I'm in control. Even if I look around, I can clearly see I'm not. So we're like this, pretending to look around. At least I feel this one hard thing, which makes me unable to feel my heart. And then that didn't work, okay. This other way, that feels good, but that's so scary. So scary. So it's just pointing out that it's normal when we're afraid on the path. It's a normal part of the path. And it doesn't have to stop us. It is part of a process. It's not, doesn't happen usually in just two lines, in, you know, 20 seconds. Go ahead.
Is this the same fear that you mentioned, like the fear that we're going to die?
Yeah.
Which I've never experienced. I've never thought, oh my God, I'm going to die.
It might not come in words like that. It many times doesn't come in words. The body just, or the body tries to control the intensity of the pleasure, and that makes it more intense. Body, mind, whatever. Body, psyche. Yeah, it's not necessarily that I think I'm going to die in words, in my mind, think I'm going to die. Brandy, you wanted to say something?
I'm just, I'm still trying to wrap my head around exactly how to even form the question, but I think I'm grappling a bit with, you know, this metaphor with like the kitten and, you know, being completely receptive and this open space and being carried, and also the having a life where you need to make choice, because, you know, as a kitten that's being carried, like, that's beautiful to, like, know that you're not in control and to really, like, feel that and be okay with whatever, but, and the kitten's mother is making all of the moves, is making all of the choices. But at some point as an adult, like, we have to say, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. And how then do we allow or still bring that kind of openness into those situations where we're not falsely practicing this false will when we make a choice and we say, this is what I'm going to do. Whether it feels right or because we think that something guided us there or because we think we're being carried in that direction, really, like, it is us that is making this choice.
So the metaphor is not saying that the mother cat is some other thing out there. But I think it's just, it's a metaphor, first of all.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's more to get the feeling, let's go to a much more small and available kind of exercise to play with it. We're being aware of our feet. And how does it feel when what I'm relating to is my image in my mind of my feet or my associated word of feet or whatever, you know, my mental version of feet. When I'm kind of fiddling around with that, how does that feel? And when I just go, whoa, that feels kind of dead and dry, not sustainable. But there are feet, aren't there? How do I know there are feet? And then I just feel, and it's a completely different experience, And it's very alive, very spacious. And there's room for something that looks like intelligence to happen. So Almas says the essence, the intelligence of our essence can come through, etc. To me, I just find that it works well. Something emerges when we leave space. And the experience of leaving space, being an openness where direct experience kind of bubbles up. There's a feeling of brightness and ease, fluidity, and things I could never have thought of can pop up and that are so helpful. And then that can start to come into action, not only thought. that we just start to do.
Yeah, action was, I guess, more also like what stemmed the thought in my head, not necessarily choice, but like...
So playing around with how you're making, like, what really does make a decision? We have this idea that it's what, once I agree with my head, I'm going to do that, then I'm going to do that. It's not true. Every day, today, you probably decided, I don't know what you decided. You decided you're going to go to the lake, you're going to have two teas, one tea, no tea, and you did something else, not by your own permission. And it's not wrong. We might think it's wrong because I decided and it went again, or it's right. Something else happened. And sometimes it's in agreement. Sometimes our thinking is in alignment with what is emerging.
Got it.
Shai. No, okay. Anyone else, something? You were made for joy, child. The feet of you were carved for that. The ankles of you run for that. The rise of rain, the shift of the wind, the drop of a red star on a far water rim. An endless catalogue of shouts, laughters, and silent contemplations. They made you from day to day for joy, child. So that's the first part, and it has something similar with the Mary Oliver poem from the other day, of feeling this wider making of us, the wider making of a human being. And also that quality of time, so this endless catalog, it's this ongoing process of inclusion in a wider whole. And also let the rise of rain, I love that. Rain does rise, but usually we think of rainfall. So the seeming impossible or the unexpected, the rise of rain. So just that getting in touch with this ongoing making of itself of our lives. And how continually, again and again, something can pop up that has intelligence, kindness. Just by being in touch with what is. So then the poem continues. There's a gap, and then the poem continues. The very next stanza. And he's using the word he. So I don't know how I read it. I might shift from time to time to she, but it's just this one person. But so we can all kind of hear it as intimately as possible. Well, he sat up and said to himself, "This is good. I will go to it." Till then, he had been satisfied with himself. Now there came back an old unrest, carried over from a grandfather as was, the one grandfather he had failed to live up to. He had a hunch. Do you know what a hunch is? Do you know what a hunch is?
Yeah.
Do you know what a hunch is, Sandraji? Yeah. He had a hunch, a new hunch, another and another. Do you know what a hunch is? Yeah, okay. Instead of ideas, whims, he had hunches. So he said, "This is good. I will go to it." So in almost the opposite language from what we're using, he's describing experientially. Coming into the natural joy, letting the joy have us, letting the pull, the longing have us. And then that just allows that whole sweater to unravel of ignoring all of that of life, and it comes alive. And we find ourselves included in all that wider and wider and wider life, ongoing. An endless catalog of shouts, laughters, and silent contemplations, everything. They made you from day to day for joy, child. So the openness of the construction of a human being, the ongoing construction of a human being that includes far and near, the openness of that makes us for joy and the pull, the longing, the knowing of our potential. the willingness to be led by another pull, another force than programming, than pleasant pain, pleasantness and pain. And then something sits up. It's like, well, if it's kind of like, if this is the situation, well, something kind of comes up and says to oneself, so we're included in all that, and something particular can happen in the goodness. This is good. I will go to it. I'm willing. Something happens, an action happens, and then we know what we did, rather than I'm going to do that. So till then, he'd been satisfied with himself. We're using the opposite word. We're saying, till then, we'd been unsatisfied with life. Till then, he'd been satisfied with this. He'd been going along with his assumptions and his programming, and he thought that was all he could do. He believed the Nazi news. Now, there came back an old unrest. Now there came back that just because I like to fight in that sense of the resistance. Not because I'm going to win. Because this needs to be done, I'm doing it, and that's by itself enough. So an old unrest carried over from a grandfather as was. So sometimes there's a person, it might not be our actual grandfather, it might be, that helps us keep room for what we can be but are not. That the Nazi news is saying is impossible, never gonna happen. But something in the underground news keeps resonating with that place that we haven't dared, that we haven't trusted to go to. And that's all. Then we're ready to kind of be bigger, to live up to ourselves, the openness, the bigness, the intelligence that comes through. And then there comes a hunch, a new hunch, another and another. Instead of ideas, whims, she had hunches. So she said, this is good. I will go to it. May all beings be at ease. Free to devote our lives to the momentum towards awakening for all, including ourselves.